This is 69, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry since the dawn of man, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon, and into what stuff actually means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. The podcasts are free and I try to get a new one out weekly, but I travel a lot so sometimes I'll miss a week. The 69 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported since the start by Jeremy Gavin and the fine folks at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at ScreenFeed.com. It's now been 5 years since Stratacache acquired the CMS software company Scala, which had kind of devolved from the digital signage industry's dominant player to just one of many options. When Stratacache CEO Chris Riegel did the deal, there were lots of people wondering what might happen. Was he buying the company for its customer base and vast reseller channel, or did he have other plans? In short order, he jokingly made up Trump-style red ball caps that said, "Make Scala great again." 5 years later, Scala is a wildly different company and product, with a much smaller reseller channel and an integrated retail-centric platform that has largely been rewritten and restructured. Riegel has been a frequent guest of this podcast, and that's because he's wicked smart and frank about what's going on in this industry. We talk about the five-year journey he's had with a renewed Scala, but also go deep into what's happening in the marketplace globally, and we nerd out on the micro-LED factory he's spinning up in Oregon, and when it will start producing both small and large format display material. As always, it's a valuable, insight-filled 35 minutes or so. Mr. Riegel, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So about 5 years ago now, you bought Scala. And at the time, there were being lots of industry people who were looking at that going, okay, what's going to happen now? Is it going to be absorbed by Stratacache? Is it going to accelerate or what's going to happen? And you sent me a note the other day saying, hey, we're coming up on 5 years. It's an interesting story to tell. So what's the story?
Yeah, it's been a hell of a ride, probably the best way to say it. So 5 years ago, we decided, hey, there's something here in Scala, something absolutely worth growing and saving. When we stepped into the acquisition, Scala, arguably one of the, I think, top brands from a visibility and great legacy, great history,
yep,
but had kind of atrophied, to be honest. So we saw what was truly a global footprint, and that Scala was really one of the first in the market, had grown out a global entity. And it was a good acquisition, good strategic for us to be able to buy that asset, bolt the power that we had in the North American markets, in the Indian markets, to that Scala infrastructure in Europe, in the Nordics, in the Middle East, in Japan, in Australia, and really convert. Scala was the entity that allowed Stratacache to convert from being a pocketed global to a full global, and now really hitting every country around the world, but principally, you know, 28 offices around the world, being able to service those global customers. And Scala gave us that global reach. Now that was not without some interesting challenges, some interesting discoveries during the path. So it's been quite a ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I can remember going to an Infocom back in like the late 2000s, 2007, something like that. And Scala was the company in digital signage in terms of visibility and everything on the Infocom floor. Like, they were the monster. And I just kind of slowly, over a matter of the next 5-6 years, saw it, you know, kind of, as you say, just diminished.
And what you had in Scala, and what is amazing about Scala, is that there is such a tribal knowledge and such a capability towards digital visual communication and optimizing that experience for the customer. It's really this amazing retail practice with a skill set I've never seen matched throughout. What we did in coming in was really kind of update that, bring that more modern, more current. And some examples, you know, Scala was always principally a Windows platform. Well, Windows is not the same thing that it was 20 years ago. So We brought Scala into the Linux world. We brought Scala from x86 processors into the ARM processor world. We've updated big chunks of the code to modernize and refresh and then kind of updated a lot of the technical teams within to say, what do you do for the next 20 years? In coming in kind of as a change agent, what I saw was the equivalent of the old house with great bones, but needed to be updated and refreshed. Mm-hmm. Some of that was tech, some of that was people. But to say, what do you do to stabilize and turn around this business and make it valid for the next 20 or 30 years looking forward? There was too much looking back and too much resting on the laurels. And we're very much about challenging and growing people and technical teams. And how do you make that better and really tackle that problem every day? The beauty and the horror of technology is that yesterday means nothing for tomorrow. That you have to go out and hit every single day, focus on where is that market going, how are you evolving that experience, because the market doesn't stand still.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about Scala at the time was, as we were saying, it was a platform that was kind of getting some hair on it, so to speak. And what you had, though, was this huge reseller channel, just like resellers all around the world. And you kind of repositioned things, right, where you went away somewhat from channel to much more direct sales.
I'd kind of counter that a bit.
Okay.
What Scala had coming in when we did the acquisition, Scala had about 300 resellers around the world. Mm-hmm. Of those 300, 200 of them were companies that did $5,000 or $10,000 a year, negligible revenue.
Okay.
What we've done, we continue to have within Scala a full reseller channel, have grown that significantly. What we've done is really focused that to say, I want fewer and better resellers in that environment. The crown jewel of Scala is, hey, you have 16,000 customers around the globe as existing live customer base. And some of those customers, hey, you take a Citibank as an example. Citibank should not be buying product from Dave's AV Barn in Baltimore because they have requirements that are much more stringent and much more tiered towards, hey, I need direct manufacturer support. So in that environment, we've continued to grow that channel. You've seen partnerships like Akuhodo with Scala and others on the global side. You'll see later this year, two other big, big announcements, reseller partnerships. So what we've really done is said, hey, it doesn't make sense to have 300 plus resellers that you're just a line item on the card. The other part to that is with 300 resellers, you'd see a deal. Hey, here's a deal that pops up in Italy. And you'd have 10 guys racing each other to the bottom.
Right.
For us and resellers, the key point is to say, we want them to be profitable. We want them to have success. And in having that success, and I'll use Latin America as an example. In Latin America, when we acquired Scala, there was a channel, but it was just a dog-eat-dog environment. You guys were trying to win deals based on pennies. We cleaned that channel up, went from 50 to really 5 or 6, and deployed a Scala Operations Center in Mexico City to be able to support the entire region, then work with the partners to bring profitable deals to them and recurring profitable deals so that they have a vested interest. There's hundreds of guys in the CMS space with very little differentiation. Mm-hmm. And I'll use the example, one of the partners that we work with in Brazil said, hey, I can get a 35% margin on your competitor's product. And I said, that's great. What are you selling that product at? Oh, $1 a month. So 35% of that, great. You can't run the business on that. How do you do profitable deals and make sure that channel is profitable and clean that up quite a bit?
Is it a challenge then when, around the world with all these different options out there and all these companies going out with, as you say, a buck a month kind of SaaS licensing deal? They'll look at Scala and, I don't know what the number is, but it's going to be higher. And they'll say, well, you're too expensive.
Quite candidly, in those environments, the customers that are willing to pay $1 a month for SaaS and nothing more, you don't want. There's no revenue there. And I would applaud my valued competitors, what we'd call the gangsters of Gangnam, and trying to just liquidate the value of software in industry-wide. But there is a difference. And when you get into the mid-tier, the large-tier enterprise space that we hunt, if you want to pay a buck, go buy somebody else's product. There's no value there. You can't afford to support it. Can't afford to provide services on it. you're going to get exactly what you deserve. It's funny to watch in these dollar SaaS guys, the customers that literally change every year. They'll just go from vendor A to vendor B to vendor C to vendor D. There's no consistency of experience. There's no feature set there. And okay, knock yourselves out, but there's no margin. There's no margin. Why take the headache?
Mm-hmm. So your lead company, StrataCash, tends to focus on bank and QSR more than anything else. Do you get into retail, or do, when that opportunity comes along, you're going to tend to angle the prospect towards Scala?
It depends on the environment. What we have done within Scala is really built a group of people globally that have what I'd call agency level chops within that retail space. So we've got designers, graphic artists, we've got retail practice experts that can go in and really engage a retailer from the Scala side, help them with the mission of what do you want to do? What are you trying to accomplish? Not how do I put this screen on the wall at the lowest possible price? That's really further evolved into analytics, into artificial intelligence, where we're able to say, when I take Scala as an example and bolt that to our walk-based mobile sensor business, when I bolt that to our SAIT, our artificial intelligence retail tracking business, the ability to say, hey, you saw this image on a sign. I'm tracking your cart or your basket. I know you're in that area. I know that you saw it. You converted on it. Here's the efficacy based on demographic or time or visit in unique shopper, unique customer. You've got to go in that retail practice down to more closing the loop, providing the evidence, the detail around it, because it's such a results-driven business.
Is retail evolving in terms of what the ask is for Scala and other companies?
Tremendously. So I would contrast now, kind of having a little bit of a different view. Retail in the West is atrophying at the moment, principally because you have Bezos that's just out cracking heads left and right. You know, Amazon continues to grow in strength amazingly, and online grows globally. But what you're starting to see now, and especially if you look at Asia, what you're starting to see is the emergence of what we call organized retail. You take a market like India that has literally 2 million small retail shops, and those are starting to organize into actual retail chain, actual organized chain-based branded consistency of experience the way that you'd see it in the West. The opportunities and where we're seeing ridiculous growth is in India, in China, in Indonesia, Malaysia, in these emerging markets where retail is organizing now and becoming much more structured. And you know, I think, and I say this knock on wood, hopefully COVID goes away, but within 2022, that's probably the first year within the company that we see selling 1 million plus screens, players, software licenses. That's up from 300,000 to 400,000 a year on average. So we're just seeing this aggregation now of critical mass, but that's really being led by the Asian markets.
You would think between India and China and these emerging economies that those would be the guys more than anyone else who would migrate towards the buck a month kind of SaaS thing.
Yes and no. There's always a cost pressure there, don't get me wrong, but there's also a value in experience. There's a value in being able to deliver that solution. The retail systems in many of these countries are just not quite as mature at the IT side and at that infrastructure side. So when you're talking to a retailer in the US, do a lot of work with Walmart, combined close to 5,000 stores, but then you step into Reliance India, and Reliance is deploying 200,000 plus locations in India the next 18 months. It's just a different scale. Coming into that understanding of scale, yep, numbers are different pricing model to do that. But hey, if I'm up a factor of 40 on the number of doors, you'll still come out okay on the other end of that.
Is the feature set in terms of what they want different in these emerging markets? Like if you're talking to Walmart, that's a very sophisticated retailer. They're probably interested in analytics. They're probably interested in front-end advisory, consulting, creative, all those sorts of things. When you're talking the scale in India, is it just more we need the core functionality of digital science software?
Well, what you're seeing is more of a hybrid in India of the on-prem and online kind of merging within those stores. But you're also seeing, for lack of a better phrase, an absolute hunger and desire. If you look at some of the large retailers in India and China who have said, hey, we're going to be the biggest company in the world. They have drive, they spend money. The existing US and Western big retailers are still kind of dealing with, hey, things are good enough that we don't really have to press and change quite as much. But you've got drive in India and China that I think you'll see within the course of the next 3 years, this flip, where as these Eastern markets start to really organize their retail systems, they'll be orders of magnitude bigger than what you see here in the West.
When I look in the West at digital signage in retail, it seems to have gone away from stores that, you know, they were putting a whole pile of LCDs all over the place to now it seems like they put in one DirectView LED feature wall, maybe a couple other signs at checkout, that sort of thing, but that's it. What's happening in these emerging markets? Same thing?
In emerging markets, you're usually dealing in a much smaller format. So yep. Instead of having the 200,000 square foot super center approach, you might have the 2,000 square foot cell phone store or the 2,000 square foot health and beauty store. As those are organizing up, you're seeing that becoming a more multifunction point to say, hey, what is this new hybrid of having a retail store that could be a small corner market bodega, but I could also order a cell phone there. I could order product remotely. I could have it delivered in. And you're dealing with a population there that's not nearly as wealthy as you have in the Western world, much more subsistence living, but the ability to say, hey, how can we lower costs? How can we improve capabilities where that retail store might be the real lifeline out to the bigger e-commerce environment? I'll use an example with one of the customers that work with in India. They partnered with Google on a new cell phone. So you have a new Google cell phone that's being introduced to that market where the cost of the phone is $4, not $4 a month, not $4 a quarter, but $4.
Wow.
So it's how do you unleash the power between China and India of 2.5 billion people from a retail perspective to streamline that, to bring more and more opportunity. Of those 2.5 billion people, 2 billion of them are not particularly wealthy, but still have needs, still can take advantage of these services within.
So is it fair to say they're doing digital posters more than anything else in these kind of small footprint places?
You're typically seeing like a hybrid digital sign interactive kiosk kind of use case from 21 inch to 32 inch. We did the acquisition in China a few years back of what we call now our Link tablet series. But those hybrid devices that are multifunction, that could be a digital sign, could be interactive, can have payment, can have mobile device scan. It's that multifunction Swiss Army knife that's extremely popular.
Through the pandemic, I've been curious because I get carpet bombed with PR all the time. Companies saying we're going away from interactive touch and so on. It's got to be contactless. That we're going to use voice. We're going to use QR code scans. Throw the controls of the screen to the phone and so on. And I've always been extremely skeptical of the adoption of that. What have you seen?
You're 100% right. When the pandemic really hit, I've continued to travel pretty much nonstop. But I was in Portland, Oregon, checking into American Airlines, and they had 20 check-in kiosks there. And they didn't say, hey, we're going to have voice check-in, or we're going to have haptics, so you don't have to touch it, or have gestural. They just had a 98-cent container of Lysol wipes. So once you touch the screen, you sanitize your hands, you move on. The haptics, the voice, the mobile, there's capabilities with each of them, but the retrofit costs are not trivial. And the customer, think of what you've had with gesture-based interaction systems. That's been around forever. It's still never really used. Why?
Because the customer doesn't want.
Exactly. It's the magic mirror syndrome. Bad ideas don't go away. They just come back every 3 years. Within these things like haptics and others, can they have a benefit? Sure. Is it going to be broadly used? No, it's still niche.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company's Greenfeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit screenfeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
Before we turn the recording on, we were talking a little bit about where the industry more broadly is at. And I was saying I'm stupid busy, and I get a sense from a number of people that they're also stupid busy, and you said the same.
The markets are, you know, where it's choppy simply because of shutdowns and customers trying to figure out what the future looks like, but it's incredibly busy. And as we've seen consolidation, COVID is going to shake a lot of companies out of the space, especially coming from the older, what I'd call AV sector. That market's compressed dramatically, especially in Europe and Asia Pac.
Especially if they add live events as a big part of it.
Well, even that, or hey, if you have something that requires your services when people are in the office, if they're not in the office, forget about it. We've talked to literally dozens and dozens of companies trying to sell or trying to find a new sponsor to be able to survive. So that's going to be rough. But the market as a whole, especially as we're looking at 22, is white hot with projects and opportunities. And COVID is putting some chlorine into the digital signage gene pool for sure.
And why is it so hot now? Like, what one of the things that I've written about and observed is the thing about all the lockdowns and all the changes that were enforced on how people did their everyday tasks and activities was that things changed. And the only way to communicate that was using dry erase marker boards in the lobby of a store and stuff taped to the doors and the whole bit. And those companies that had digital signage already, you know, had a lead. They had something they could use. Is that part of it?
I'll give you a pretty good example. So we do all the software and systems for McDonald's in the US, several hundred thousand digital menu boards, both indoor and outdoor, and have had the privilege of doing that for the last 13 years. In that environment where you deal with product shortages, hey, there's a distribution problem on pork at this distribution plant. There's a opportunity for a delay of this product at another plant. The digital menu boards at drive-thru and at indoor can adjust on a moment's notice based on supply chain disruptions. Mm-hmm. They can change price based on commodity change. The other part that's really coming into our business very, very heavily in those same use cases is now the labor shortages. So, hey, do I go from a complex menu when I have a crew of 14 people to, oh, crud, only 7 people showed up this morning and I need to simplify that menu because I don't have the ability to deal with the same velocity because I'm crew light at that point. So you're seeing digital use cases in areas for us, whether it be the menu board practice in QSR or retail, that the ability of digital to adjust on a moment's notice, and where I can take, as an example, sensors and know how many people showed up as crew, how many customers in that drive-through line, what are my product supplies looking like because I have access to point of sale or product logistics information, and change that on a dime, you can really help keep those businesses moving. And within the pandemic, when indoor dining was shut down, the amount of work, and I'd say conservatively today, we have a greater than 50% market share in QSR in the US and about a 40% market share globally. The ability to help our customers continue to operate as close to flawlessly as possible through the pandemic has been a really big success across multiple brands as we've continued to expand business dramatically.
And that's not a trivial thing to do, to stitch all those systems together. Do you have to fight against companies to say, well, you know, we're API driven, we can integrate all these systems, we could do that for you, versus actually doing it and having the experience to do it?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We always run into that challenge that we call the competitor's magic wand. So you go into the presentation and you're competing with little guy XYZ and he says, you know what? I've got 6,000 signs out there and this is super simple and it's easy and it's not going to cost anything and it's magic. And I say, well, I have 3.5 million science in fleet. I have 1,100 people. We run 24/7 operations, and it's not easy. It's not simple. And there is no such thing as magic. If you want to buy the magic beans from my competitor, more power to you. But having the experience to say, you know, large scale, big customer, complex projects, we've earned our place at the table in those discussions to be able to say, hey, choose or not choose us, that's your call, but we'll give you a full view of what the reality of this thing is like in a use case of a McDonald's where 400,000 plus screens that are under our management. There's something that breaks every day. That's the nature of the beast. But how do you stay ahead of that power curve in the large customers we work with globally? I had a really fun customer interaction about 2 months ago, one of our larger retail apparel customers who decided to speak out against the Uyghur situation in China, called and said, hey, I have PLA troops in my store telling me to turn off our digital signs. What should we do? Well, do they have guns? Yes. Then you should turn off your digital signs. And by the way, we told you this would happen, not the political statement, but you were hosting outside of China against our advice. We warned you. Now you see what happens. Unfortunately, it's just a diverse and complex world. There are no magic wands. And a lot of customers, we call them rebound customers. In our environment, the customer that says, hey, I'm going to buy from the competitor that's going to do $1 a month in SaaS and is making me all these promises. Okay, cool. Here's our information. Call us back in 6 months when you see that's hollow, because the amount of work that it takes in any scale retail network to keep this stuff going is not trivial, regardless of the technology.
Yeah, I would imagine you see that over and over again. Company X that tried the cheap route and then discovered that wasn't a great idea. Now we're going to actually pay some real money.
Well, my favorite current theme is the customers that say, it's not that complex, we're going to build it ourselves. Okay, cool. We've done this for 22 years. We have 600 million plus invested in capital and tens of thousands of man years in development. But if you can put it together in 6 weeks with your internal teams, good luck.
Mm-hmm. With Scala and retail, are there retail vertical markets that are more active than others? Like I'm thinking you're talking about the bodegas or the equivalent of bodegas in India and so on. Those are essential services. People need food. They need cigarettes and just whatever. They don't necessarily need fast fashion.
You know, Scala's been really, really successful both previously and within our stewardship in automotive, in retail apparel, in high value goods, luxury environments, but also in chain grocery, C-store, that the depth of that practice, and especially as we brought order to some of the chaos we saw day one, the ability to engage those customers that are understanding that digital signage is not just, hey, I'm going to put a pretty picture on that screen and it's going to do something. What is it going to do? I don't know. No, this has to have business metrics. Why are you making the investment? What's the return? Define success. And this is a tool. You're going in any of those environments and competing for an investment to say, why am I going to spend money on digital signage versus a new retail X or Y or Z? Earn your place at that table. Keep that place at the table by delivering a value to a customer. I can go into a lottery environment or a QSR environment or retail environment and say, I'm going to give you X lift with Y percent greater margin. I'm going to prove that point, and I'm going to give you full access to all the statistics so you can double check my math. If you can find somebody else that can do that, knock yourselves out. But if I can deliver you in a retail or QSR or gaming environment, 1-3% lift and a margin lift of 3-5%, it's a big number.
Yeah. So tell me what's going on with the micro LED plant that you're building out in Oregon. Well, not you're building, it's there, you're retrofitting.
It's there. It's a pretty wild ride. Micro LED as a tech, we've been researching it 5+ years, made the dive into buying the fab 2 years ago, and have been spending a tremendous amount of time on research and development subsequent. Micro LED is a unbelievable dislocator. And when I say a dislocator, today, if you look at the Asian display cartels, they have been able to control a market not unlike OPEC, by having a very high cost of entry, having a bunch of barriers around that, the typically government sponsorship to that marketplace. Micro-LED is a different beast. In the intersection that's coming between what would be called the epitaxial world, growing LEDs, and the silicon world, all of a sudden the cost to pin up a plant is 1/10 to 1/20 what it was before. Mm. So you can have companies that can compete and can build out next generation displays without having to have government sponsorship. If you look at, and I'm not trying to wave the nationalist economic flag, but if you look at the last two, three generations of display, whether TFT LCD or AMOLED or OLED or other, a lot of that tech is developed in the US and North America. None of it's manufactured here. Why? Because we don't have great industrial policy at the governmental level to compete. When you look at Korea and China, how governments sponsor the building of those fabs, that's the way that they do it. That's the game. That being said, you're never going to have that happen here. So
it was happening in Wisconsin.
Yeah, exactly. Don't hold your breath on that one. But the central planning model has changed. And with micro-LED, you can bring up a fab at a fraction of the cost, but also then have a product that is less expensive because of the simplicity of a direct view, direct emissive view product. So there's some really, really exciting stuff going on.
But you're not focused on large format for micro-LED. The volume is all in like wearables and things like that, right?
No, there's a big space in large format. The initial micro-LED use cases have been small format, wearables, optic, precision optics, things such as that, simply because there are some challenges in the technology like mass transfer that had not yet been figured out or distilled that made it really, you can only be cost competitive in those small environments. But if I take the equation of a square meter of glass, micro-LED can deliver a square meter of glass at an equivalent resolution to TFT LCD or to OLED for between 50 and 60% of the fab cost of that product. So it can be super competitive. And in our use case, we'll absolutely go after large format. And I want to make sure that our friends in solar are aware of that.
Mm. So at some point, I think you told me in the past that you thought by end of year, you'd be at least doing rapid prototyping.
Yeah, so we're now in the joy of receiving all equipment late just because of the pandemic and the slower nature of manufacturing and getting anything in. That being said, by Q1 we'll be in prototype. What we're doing is putting a lot of focus on, without nerding out on it too deeply, 300 millimeter epitaxy on silicon. So today, most LEDs are built on 150 millimeter sapphire, which works, has worked for 20 years, is very precise. We're taking the step to go 300 mil GaN on silicon, which is a more complex process. But once you're in the silicon world, the ability to then scale out silicon-based emitters directly to bond to CMOS 300 millimeter silicon wafers, you can start doing some really interesting stuff that breaks the mold.
Yeah, at that point, I understood most of that, but the idea is that the way conventional LED is made, it's machines that are picking LEDs or batches of LEDs and placing them on substrate, and it just takes a long time and a lot of cost and energy to do that, right?
It does, and within the LED industry today, that LED can be grown, that the large format, large emitter, 1 millimeter plus LED, those are grown in epitaxial processes that are not particularly clean. Mm-hmm. When you get into micro LED, we're talking emitters that are 3 microns by 3 microns by 5 mics. So you're dealing with super small stuff. As an order of magnitude, the LEDs that we're making are smaller than the coronavirus. So when you deal with making extremely small emitters, the ability to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm able to build, some call it a smart pixel, some would just call it a digital Lego. I'm able to build a emitter directly bonded to a micro IC and build the smart pixel concept. There's some really cool stuff that you could do there. You'll probably see the first mass commercialization of that coming out from Apple with wearables. but the applications around it are myriad, and it is 100% a game changer.
Do you see the product, the end product for the digital signage market being the equivalent to flat panel displays, like you'd be selling 85-inch micro LED panels, or do you see it as large, like big ass LED video walls?
Yeah, great question. I think our core mission is I'm not going to fight Xi Jinping to win aisle 7 at the Costco for the 85-inch $399 television. Chinese can have that market.
Well, yeah.
No question. In micro LED, if you're getting into large format sizes, you'll most likely be within the container of tiled panels. So maybe you're at 200 to 300 millimeter tiles to be able to get to large formats. But within that, I think that the differentiation there between micro LED and call it mini LED, 50 mics or up, it is minimal. What you're going to find in the greatest benefit of micro LED are those environments where you're using the fact that your emitter is so small, it's not visible to the naked eye. So you can do transparency through window glass. You can bend and curve it. So the curved surfaces, the bent surfaces, the flex surfaces, because the emitters are so small, they're within the bend radiuses of the substrates. There's a lot of really cool stuff you can do where you're not just fighting the low price commoditized markets. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been to Shenzhen 30 times. And, you know, there's 100,000 LED companies in Shenzhen. Unless you can differentiate yourself from that mass market, you're dead day one. So you have to pick your battles correctly.
So that set of Corning videos that have come out in the past, you know, 10 years or so, 5-10 years, about a day in glass where you have all this, these dynamic visuals that are just showing up on countertops and windows and everything else, this is what's going to happen with this technology, right?
Absolutely. The ability to make display a more natural interface to the consumer, where it doesn't have to be a standalone display device, where it's integrated into third-party devices or features. Corning had great vision around that, obviously with the goal to sell more glass, but the idea was right. And now that this is continuing to transition, think of your smart home, think of your smart car, think of your smart whatever. All of that is microprocessor driven in one form or another. So how do you associate displays that are much more natural to the user's experience as opposed to something that's a bulky bolt-on, whether that's in a car, on a refrigerator, in a window, making that just part of that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Always a pleasure. Thank you for spending some time.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and you learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around since 2016. You can click around the site and find scores of conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9. That's at 16-9.net. You'll find thousands of posts by me and expert guest writers about this industry. I don't run a press release republishing mill. If something makes it on 16.9, that means it matters in some way to the business. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.